So we're on week number six. We're back into the text of David's mighty men. And that's what this is all about. It's about these guys that helped David establish the greatest kingdom in Israel's history. Now, they would expand it. Solomon would expand it to its greatest, you know, territory. But David was the first king who united Israel and brought them into, that really took over the promised land and drove out everybody. That was David. And, you know, of course, David also had a heart for God, which is why we remember him more. But David was not able to do what he did unless he had those 30 mighty men. And they were incredible people. And so how do you get there? How do you get to be the kind of a person that can do incredible things for God? We don't normally think of warriors as ministers, but that's what they were, because they were help establishing God's kingdom on earth. And that parallels very closely to where we are today. You know, we're establishing God's kingdom on earth. And so, you know, that's what we want to do. That's what we want to be. And so how do we get there? So some of you who are noticing the title, you know, this is not going to be the fun sermon that we've had in the past. But I want to set this up. Now, this is actually in 2 Samuel 23 is where the David Mighty Men passage is, but they're talking about exploits that happened before. And this is one of the exploits. So I'm going to set this up from 1 Samuel. What happened was David departed a place called Nob, and he went to this cave of Adullam, which is still there today. If you go toward the Holy Land, you can go there. And when his brothers and his fathers heard of it, they ran down to him. So this is after David kills Goliath, and he's brought into the king's household. He marries the king's daughter. He's a hero of Jerusalem. And then Saul gets extremely jealous and paranoid about him, because the people love him more than they love Saul. And he just sees his kingdom slipping away, and he tries to kill him, and David's on the run for his life. So that's where this takes place. Everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. Wow, what a tribe. Yeah, there's my people, discontented, discouraged, and in debt. Okay, go start a church with them, you know. So that's where he is. And he was a captain over them, and there were about 400. So a lot of discontent people in debt go rushing over to David. You know, they kind of are the word's out that he was the anointed king by now, and everybody's waiting for that day to happen. And so they gather together. But the 30 that we're going to talk about in this book haven't arrived yet. These are just the other people. The 30 will arrive, and when the 30 arrive is when they really step out and do things. But meanwhile, Saul is still watching after him. He's trying to find him, and it's almost like, where's Waldo? You know, every time he pops up on the radar, they go rushing after him. He's got this like hit squad of people with him. You know, this could really be a dark movie. You know, they'd be all wearing black with evil masks, you know, the hit squad. And they get there, but when they get there, he's gone. And so then this guy pops up, and he only shows up in the Bible for a little while, this Doeg the Edomite. Now, Edomite's not one of the tribes of Israel. He's not Jewish, but he's trying to get in good with King Saul. He's this really kind of snaky, you know, if you guys watch, you know, Game of Thrones, and repent if you do. But Littlefinger, he'd be like Littlefinger. He's kind of sneaky guy, you know, in the back. So he was standing by the servants of Saul, and he says, well, I know where he was. I saw the son of Jesse, that's David, coming to Nob, and he met with the priest there. So I know where he is. He was over at the priest. In fact, he goes on, you know, puts this little thought in his head. He inquired of the Lord for him. Can you imagine? This priest prayed for him. Well, what's wrong with that? You know, he's clearly evil. He prayed for them and gave him provisions, and he gave him the sword of Goliath, which, by the way, was David's sword. He took it off his dead body, if you remember, and he lost it when he went running. It shows up there, and when he comes there, he's hungry, and he doesn't have but just a couple guys with him, and he has no weapons, and this priest prays for him, gives him food, and said, I have something for you. And this is like one of these moments, if you make the movie, that's the moment, right? I have something for you, and oh, this Goliath sword. Okay, the other thing is, when they gave him provisions, they gave him sanctified bread, which was against all kind of law. Right, Jewish law. Jesus refers to this later when he's talking about stupid Jewish laws. He refers to this moment. And so what happened here was, he was the chosen, he was the anointed of God, and the priest said, well, here, you can have the sanctified bread then. You know, you're anointed by God. And so that's why he gave it to him. So Saul just sees red now. Uh-oh, this priest, you know, helped David, so I need to go. So he brings him over and he says, now, why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me? And you have given him bread and a sword and inquired of God for him. How dare you pray for him? You know, this is nuts. So he would rise up against me, lying in an ambush. Nothing of the sort, of course. David's running for his life. He's not trying to ambush Saul. He's just trying to get left alone. That's all David's trying to do. Now, this guy, this priest here, Imelekak, he may not be considered one of David's mighty men, But what he does right now is amazingly brave. Because first of all, Saul's about 7 foot tall. He's angry, and he's a little bit crazy. And he's accusing him now. You'd expect him to disseminate, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, that wasn't really what happened. Or, you know, he found the bread. I didn't get it. Or something like that. And I don't know, the sword fell out and he grabbed it. What was I to do? Something like that. But he doesn't. He stands up to him. And I love what he says. He says, well, who among your servants is as faithful as David? And I see him now looking at all the guys behind him. You know, all these soldiers they're ready to kill. Are any one of these guys as faithful as David's been to you? Because David was faithful. David was his bodyguard. David played him music when he needed, you know, the spirit to be sent away. David's been nothing but faithful. He went off and fought battles Saul wouldn't fight and won them for him. You know, he never took anything. He says, David's as faithful as they come. How can you do it? He was honored in your own house. You honored him, don't you remember? And did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? In other words, I have prayed for David before. Guess what? I will pray for him again. I'm the priest. That's kind of what I do. And he's the anointed of God. I'll pray for him. And he comes, I'm going to pray for him. He said, far be it from me. I will never stop praying for David. You have to understand that. This is my job. But don't let the king impute or accuse me of anything. For your servant knows nothing of this whole affair. In other words, if you and David had a fight, I know nothing about it. Here's what I know. David needed help and I gave it to him. He's the anointed of God. He's loyal to you. He's a good Israeli soldier. I took care of him. So the king, you know, you think he'd be a little bit, you know, taken aback by the priest, you know, standing there before him, voicing God's words to him. Instead, the king doubles down. You're going to die. I'm done with you. Okay, I'm done talking to you. And he turns to the hit squad behind him and says, kill him. Put them all to death. Because their hand, all of them, are with David. And they knew he was here, and they didn't reveal it to me. So that means they must die. Listen, paranoia is not a fruit of the Spirit. In case you're wondering, the fruits of the Spirit, paranoia doesn't show up. And if you're ever with somebody and they seem to start getting paranoid, you need to understand that person is not hearing the voice of God. And we know that because we know that if you're really, truly walking with God, you cannot possibly be paranoid because of what Paul says in Romans 8. What then shall we say? If God is for us, who can be against us? How can you be paranoid if God's with you? Everybody's out to get me, but not God, right? Okay, well, then I'm cool. As long as God's on my side, I don't care who's out to get me. I have God on my side, and if he's here, I don't care. I have no care in the world. I'm never going to be paranoid. So we know that Saul has slipped. He used to be the anointed of God, but he is far, far from that. But he just went one step too far. These ruthless villains behind him, these hitmen, these assassins, even they wouldn't do that. The servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priests of the Lord. He says, whoa, King Saul, no, we're not doing it. Well, he turns and says to Doeg, you do it. And the Edomite had no problem at all. He killed them all. 85 of them, all wearing the linen ephod, which means they were all priests. They didn't have any weapons. They were priests. He kills them all. And you look at this horrible, horrible thing. I mean, Saul has just stepped so far out of line. How does this happen? Well, I'll tell you how it happens. He was afraid. Fear will always make bad decisions. When I look back at my life and I look at things I decided when I was scared, I can't find one good decision that I made. I can find a whole lot of really bad decisions that I've made. A lot of those decisions you look back on, man, how could I do that? Fear was involved. Because fear doesn't come from the Lord. Perfect love casts out fear. If you're afraid of something, you need to identify that quick because that's not the spirit from the Lord. That's coming from the devil. And that's what it was for Saul. An evil spirit was upon him. And so he was afraid. And when he makes that decision, he makes it out of fear. If you're ever making decisions out of fear, take a step back. And we do. We make a lot of, you know, if I don't do this now, I'll lose everything. Or if I don't do this now, I'm going to lose my job. And you start making these decisions. I got to make this decision right now. You know, if I don't, I'm going to lose the opportunity. If you're making decisions out of fear, it's never coming from God. You need to take a step back because probably the devil's trying to drive you into a mistake. Okay, but one guy gets away. In fact, it was his son. And somehow, this is kind of cracks me up, because Saul's looking for David for chapters and chapters, and Samuel can't find him. This guy runs straight to him. You know, it's like, everybody seems to need to find David, can find David. And he tells him what happens, and David says, look, the guy is trying to kill you, he's trying to kill me, stay with me. And he becomes David's priest. And so, you know, as all this happens. Okay, so now that's the setup. And shortly thereafter, we see the first of the 30 arrive. And I'm going to jump into 2 Samuel. But 3 of the 30 went down and came to David in harvest times. This is a few months later at the cave. And so what's happened now, because Saul has been spending all his time running around trying to find David, the Philistines have slowly encroached upon the territory. They've been taking back large sections of the territory. Part of what they took back was Bethlehem. And so they had troops there. And so while the troop of the Philistines was camping right there in the Valley of Rephaim, and that's like right outside Jerusalem, right? I mean, not Jerusalem, Bethlehem, they're right outside there. And then David moved into his stronghold. We don't know exactly where this is. He moved from the caves into his stronghold. And the garrison of the Philistines was in Bethlehem. And David had a craving and said, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is right by that gate." So this is his hometown. He's from Bethlehem. And they're staring up there, and he's thinking, "Oh, right there, there's that well of Bethlehem. If I could only go there and drink." Now, this is actually said, you know, translates different ways in different Bibles. Craving is a typical one. But this word here, avah, actually means to wish for, to long for, or to desire. This is not just, "Boy, I just have a weird craving for pickles and peanut butter." You know, this is not that. This is something much more than that. He's longing for something. And I believe what he's longing for is a simpler time. Because he used to be a shepherd right up there. And he used to go up with the sheep, and the Lord was with him. And boy, wasn't life simple then. Since I've been anointed and the king to come, my life has just really, frankly, gone to hell. It would be so much simpler if I were just a shepherd again. So I think that what David's longing for here is more than just the drink of water. That's symbolic of, "I wish I had that time back." But listen, there comes a moment on the road to your destiny that you will long for simpler times. I promise you that'll happen. When you step out with God in a ministry of any kind or any kind of a thing that he has called you to, there's going to come a time you say, "Man, life was so much simpler before I did this." And there's going to be this moment when you want to go back. The Israelites did it, and they want to go back to Egypt. Boy, it was better when we were slaves. Really? But we have a tendency to look back with rose-colored goggles, and we see things the way they weren't. And all we remember are the easy times. Boy, it just seems so much easier then. I want to go back to that. It's never good to do, but everybody feels that. I think that's what David felt there. But we have to be careful about that, because when God calls us to ministry, he expects us to finish. Because if you don't finish your ministry, what are you doing there? Jesus put it this way. He said, "No one after putting his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God." Jesus says, if you put your hand to the plow, you're going to do the work, and you're looking back, you're not fit for the work that's before you. So Jesus is real clear on this. When you step on me, I need you to finish. And it's a very clear image he's giving us, because I don't know if you've ever seen these guys plowing. But they're not. It's not easy to plow fields with these you know, oxen. And you take your eye off the row, you're going to be all over the place. You need to keep your eye on your work. And it's a temptation. I find comfort in the fact that even David had that temptation, because I'll tell you what, in the past 3 years, I've had that temptation more than once. Man, life was easier. Before we opened Spirit Chapel, it was so much easier. We had so much free time. And so we just have to stay focused, because we put our hand to the plow and God expects us to finish. But what David does is, you know, he basically makes this wish, and we see the first founding of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, these three mighty men. They hear him, and so they say, "Okay, oh, David wants water? Cool, we could do that." And so they I love this, they break through the camp of the Philistines. They sneak up in the middle of the night, and they've got guards, you know. They go right through them, because, you know, this is just who they are. And they draw water from the well, they fight their way back out, they go running back, and they give it to David. "You wanted a drink? Okay." Because basically, we can't make his life simpler, but by God, we can get our king his water. "I can't do anything about that, David. I can't make it simple for you, but you want a drink? We got that." And they did it. This is an amazing, heroic event for a glass of water. And actually kind of been studying this scripture now for 3 weeks. I knew I was going to preach on it, because it's just such a weird story stuck in the middle of 2 Samuel. Like, what? Why was this story here? I don't get it, God. Clearly there's some message here for us. That's why you put it here. But it just seems like weird, you know. You need a glass of water? Cool, you know. We'll go get you a glass of water. They put their lives at risk. They almost did the impossible. You know, they just broke through, got it, and came back. It also kind of shows you that when God's Spirit is on somebody, there's nothing they can't do. They can even do frivolous things. They're just so, you know, caught up in the Spirit. And so now you would think, again, if this were a movie, here's where David says, "Oh, you guys, I love you." And he says, you know, holds it up and toasts them, and he drinks it in front of them, you know. And then he says something inspiring, "Tomorrow we all drink from the well," or something, you know, all that. That's not what happens next. And that's what really kind of gets you, because what would you think David does next? Well, if you don't know the story, you wouldn't guess what he does next. He pours it out in front of them. He says, he would not drink it. He pours it out to the Lord. He says, "Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. I'm not drinking this. Because this is like their blood who risked their lives for this." Therefore, he would not drink it. And he pours it out as something known as a drink offering. Now, you're like, what is that? What's a drink offering? I don't get that, because it doesn't seem like a good offering, does it? You know, money's good, gold offering. You know, maybe the bull, maybe the blood, maybe the oil. But this is a drink. This is water. And he's pouring it out as an offering before the Lord. And this is actually part of the Jewish culture that goes way back before Israel was a country. Way back before there really was a nation of Israel. We see this show up with a guy named Jacob. And you may remember the story of Jacob's ladder if you sing the song when you're in Sunday school or CCD class or something. You know, this is Jacob. So what happens is Jacob is journeying to the promised land that God is going to give him, and he has no idea where he's going, and he has no idea if he's doing the right thing, and he falls asleep, and God visits him in a dream and says, this is my vision for you. It's not just I'm going to give you a land. I'm going to make you a nation which will save the world. And he wakes up, and then he does this. Jacob set up a pillar of stone, and in that place he poured out a drink offering on it. Well, that still seems pretty weird, right, that he pour out water. Oh, no, it isn't. Not when you're journeying through a wilderness and don't know where your next water's coming from, it isn't. Water's the most precious thing you have when you're in the wilderness. And what Jacob was doing was, I trust God so much, I will pour out part of what I have that I desperately want, by the way. I need that water. I want that water. I'm thirsty now just watching it go. But I trust God so much, I'm pouring out some of it as a way to say, I believe what you told me, right? So what David was doing was he sacrificed what he desired to honor the sacrifice of his men. And this bound him tighter to them than anything else he could have done. Because when they saw him do that, he says, I want this. I've wanted this. This is exactly my heart's desire, and I see what you guys did to get it, and I'm going to take this. I'm going to make it more than a drink. I'm going to make it more than a symbol of my kingship. I'm going to make it a symbol of God's kingship. And he pours it out as a drink offering to the Lord. Here's the thing. This is a sacrifice. He's actually sacrificing what he wants, because this isn't the kind of king he wants to be, where he puts his men's lives in harm's way for frivolous things. Saul's doing that. God has told him he's going to be the king. And there is coming a time when these three are going to be joined by the other 27, and they're going to be joined by an army, and he's going to drive the Philistines all the way out of Israel. And he's going to own that well in Bethlehem. And he can have a drink from it whenever he wants, and so can all his men. God is going to make him a king. And what David's saying is, I trust you for that. You will give me this in your time. And he's making a sacrifice of it, and the men love him for it. Because he sees what they did, not just something trivial, that was cool, but this was a sacrifice. You risked your blood. And we have to understand that on the way to our destiny, on the way to achieving our dream, we are going to have to sacrifice. I know that's not preached very much anymore. In fact, if you turn on TV, it's mostly, no, you're going to go from victory to victory, from mountaintop to mountaintop. God just wants you to be happy. If you have enough faith, you're just going to be blessed. No matter what happens, don't worry. God's always working everything out, and you're going to be blessed. Okay? That's not enough of the gospel. In fact, it's so little of the gospel that I believe it's false teaching. There is sacrifice on the way to your destiny. You know, if you're going to step into lion pits, you better understand that sometimes it's a sacrifice. There was a guy, I found this story. His name's J.W. Tucker. In 1962, he was a missionary for Assemblies of God denomination. And he went to the Congo, which was a very, very dangerous place at the time. The Congo was dangerous if you were from there. It was really dangerous if you're from someplace else. And he went there, and it got so volatile, they pulled them out. He and his family had pulled them out. They pulled all the missions out. They had started a little mission there, had barely got it going, and it just got so bad. Warlords were rising up, and they had all these little kings. They were always fighting each other for turf and things, almost like gang wars in New York. And so they pulled them out. And then later, a couple years later, he got the calling from the Lord to go back. And so he told his family and he told his friends, I just feel I need to go back and try to revive the mission that we started. And one of his friends said, I've been reading about it from the U.S. Department of Justice. They put out these alerts, and I've been reading about the situation there. It's very, very volatile. And J.W. Tucker told him, I just feel that God has called me to go in. He said, but don't you understand? I don't think you're going to make it back out. And J.W. Tucker said something amazing. He said, he didn't tell me I need to get back out. He just told me I had to go in. Now, I'm the grandson of a missionary. And when I see that, there's something in my heart that just goes boom, you know? And that's just amazing faith to do that kind of a thing and say, I'm just going because God told me to go. I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but I'm going to go because God told me to go, so I'm going. And now I wish I could tell you that he went there and the mission flourished and it was his great win for the Lord, but that's not J.W. Tucker's story. What happens is he's there for not very long. He's caught in the streets by a roving gang from a rival king. They catch him, they tie him up, and they beat him with broken bottles. Witnesses said they could hear him screaming for 45 minutes. When he finally went silent, they take his lifeless body, throw it in a truck, take him out to the river, and dump it into a crocodile-infested river. And that was the end of J.W. Tucker. See, here's the thing. You know, we talk about getting into the pit with a lion on a wintry day and what a great victory that was for Benaiah, and it was. But for every Benaiah, you have to understand there were hundreds who faced lions in the Colosseum in Rome. And their story didn't end like that. And God sometimes calls us to go in without us knowing if we're going to come out. God sometimes calls us to sacrifice something. Are we willing to do it or not? And in order to achieve God-sized dreams, you have to be willing to make God-sized sacrifices. Now, he sometimes calls people to simple things. David sacrificed a drink of water. J.W. Tucker sacrificed his life. Paul sacrificed his life. And right before he dies, he writes a letter to his protege, Timothy. And he says this, "I am already being poured out as a drink offering." He's in prison. He's going to be beheaded. And he knows it. But he goes on. He says, "It's okay. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future, there's laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. But my time here is done." He was prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice, and he did. But I got to be honest with you, as the grandson of a missionary, when I read the story of J.W. Tucker, there was something in me that was a little angry because it seems like his sacrifice was wasted. You know, God, why? I mean, if he's just going to go there and get killed anyway, why? And we have to understand that God has a plan that we don't see. And for 10 years, 12 years, no one knew why. But actually a story came out later from another missionary, because there is this legend of the Bomokande River, which is the river he was dropped into. This thing goes right through the Congo. And they treated it there like Egyptians treated the Nile. It was like worshipped. And the people who worked the river were treated very specially. In fact, there was a long-held tradition in that area that if someone who'd worked the river came and called a council of the tribes, everybody would come and listen to them, because whatever they were getting from the river was that important. But here is the qualification. You had to bleed in the river. If their blood mixes with the river, then they become one with the river, and then they speak for the river. That's what they thought. Well, one guy that J.W. Tucker actually got to is a guy known as the Brigadier. He's a tall guy, and he actually saved him about 2 months before his death. And this guy becomes the chief of police in this little village, which actually was the one that killed J.W. Tucker. There was a huge uproar, there was an insurrection, and the king, whatever that tribal king was, came to the Brigadier and said, "Could you speak to all at the tribal council for all the warlords and bring peace, because otherwise we're going to have civil war?" And he said he would. He had no idea what he was going to say. And the night before he spoke before the council, and no one really was willing to listen to this guy, he was just the chief of police, he was reminded of this legend. And so the next day, as he reaches everybody, he says, "I come to speak to you not as myself. I come to speak to you on behalf of one whose blood is in a river." And that got their attention. He said, "A friend of mine, J.W. Tucker, had a message for you that he never got to deliver, but his blood is in our river, and I'm going to deliver it now." And all the warlords agreed, if his blood is in the river, it's a message we'll hear. And so they all sat back, and then he preached. And when he was done, dozens, because the Spirit just moved, dozens gave it all up and became Christians. Before very long, they had a couple hundred people in that area who were Christians. Before very much long after that, they opened a church there with 4,500 people. A revival broke out because of the blood of J.W. Tucker. Listen, here's what I know. A sacrifice given to God is never wasted. So we give them sometimes not knowing, and you know, we may not get that really cool little conclusion that J.W. Tucker got. We may not see it here. It might not be on this side of the river. It might be on the other side of the Jordan before we understand it. But God calls us to these things for a purpose. He calls us for a reason. And we have to know if he's calling us to sacrifice, it's because there's something important he wants us to do. If you're being called to sacrifice, it's a great thing because God has great plans for you. But we have to be willing to do it. A lot of people's dreams die right here because we're willing to give, but we're not willing to sacrifice. It's okay to give a little, but I'm not willing to sacrifice for God's dream. And then he will find somebody who is, because he needs to know you are all in for him, because he's all in for you. So let me go back to David's sacrifice for a little bit. What happened with that? Well, we know that David eventually becomes king, but that's not what this sacrifice was about. In fact, it would be many, many years. David would never know the results of this sacrifice. But somewhere very near the very spot where he poured out that water, maybe even the very spot he poured out that water, somebody built a building. It was their house at first, and then they moved into a bigger house, and they made that the barn, where they kept the animals, and they put a manger, where God's sacrifice would reply to David's sacrifice, the sacrifice that would take away the sin of the world. God never, ever wastes a sacrifice. You may be sacrificing in silence. No one may know. And by the way, if you're sacrificing unto God, no one should know. But God sees. And he has told us that what he sees you do in secret, he will reward openly. God never wastes a sacrifice. There's a famous hymn writer who wrote a poem. This is not a hymn. As best as I know, it's not a hymn. But I want to share it with you because I think it just sums this whole thing up. There is a well in Bethlehem still, a fountain at whose brink the weary soul may rest at will. The thirsty stoop and drink. Oh, that we thirst as David then for this eternal spring and have the zeal of David's men to please a higher king. We have to understand that God's calling us to great things, and sometimes great things take great sacrifice. And if you want to see your God-sized dream come true in your life, it comes to this. Are you willing to sacrifice your desires to achieve God's dream? Would everybody please pray with me?